Foundation members, and a grant from Pete's Coffee and Tea, deep roasting and blending coffee beans since 1966. Pete's.com or 800-999-2132.
It's Wednesday, June 28, 2006. This is the KBOO Morning News. Headlines. Got student loans? You should consider consolidating before the federal government adjusts interest rates this Saturday. A constitutional amendment to ban flag desecration died in the Senate yesterday, a single vote short. And Israel has started an assault on the Gaza Strip by bombing bridges and the only power station in Gaza. Portland area weather calls for more for some clouds with highs in the low 80s.
For years, Oregon has sat proudly atop national rankings for the smallest percentage of babies born at low birth weights. In 2000, just 5.6% of Oregon babies were born underweight, compared to 7.6% nationally. But this year, the state has slipped to number 3 in the rankings. The findings were released as part of the Casey Foundation's annual Kid Count report on the health and well-being of children and teens. The report measures each state's progress in 10 categories, including infant mortality, poverty rates, and single-parent families. Oregon's overall rank for child well-being was a relatively healthy 15, but that number can be deceptive. For instance, though the Casey Foundation credits the state with only a 6% high school dropout rate, a recent study by Education Week newspaper found that 30% of Oregon students will fail to graduate from high school after 4 years. The Foundation's data shows that 35% of Oregon children live in families where neither of their parents has full-time, year-round employment. That underlies Oregon's shift toward temporary, seasonal employment.
If you've got opinions about urban development, farming, wildlife, or just about anything else related to Oregon's land, now's the time to share them with the state, according to the Oregonian. A new online survey will help identify key issues for the Big Look task force charged with reshaping Oregon land use planning. The 10-member group, including a developer, a farmer, and politicians, will issue reports to the 2007 and 2009 legislatures. Everything from creating vibrant cities to protecting private property rights is on the table. The survey includes 21 questions. It's available until Monday, July 10th, and we have a website there at which you can access the survey. You can just call in at the desk and get that.
And in one of the largest Measure 37 claims to date, a Portland man is asking Deschutes County for $200 million or the right to develop his property inside the Central Oregon's Newberry National Volcanic Monument. James Miller wants to drill geothermal energy test wells, expand a small mining operation, and build as many as 100 vacation homes on land he owns inside the caldera. Miller said county land use regulations and zoning enacted in the past 3.5 decades have limited the property's potential. His 157-acre property borders East Lake, a popular fishing and camping destination inside the monument. The land, a former mining claim from the early 20th century, has one cabin and two small pumice quarries, and is most covered by a thicket of spindly pines. The county zoned the property as open space and conservation land in 1992, a designation meant to protect important scenic or natural resources while limiting development.
The U.S. Supreme Court will consider overturning a Portland jury's verdict that the Weyerhaeuser Company had established an illegal monopoly in the market for alder saw logs. The Bush administration and some of the biggest names in corporate America have weighed in against the verdict, saying it imposed an unduly vague test for deciding when a company has a monopoly on industrial ingredients. The Supreme Court action and a rising tide of corporate opposition to the verdict and the Ninth Circuit ruling make it clear that the case raises questions that go far beyond a small sector of the Northwest timber industry. An attorney representing the plaintiffs said the Bush administration's support for Weyerhaeuser reveals an effort to dismantle the Sherman Antitrust Act of 1890. Weyerhaeuser, based in Federal Way, Washington, has argued its innocence throughout the proceedings. This from the Oregonian.
And California lawmakers rejected a bill yesterday that would have allowed the terminally ill to enlist doctors to help them commit suicide. This from Reuters. The Senate Judiciary Committee voted 3-2 to block the measure, and committee chairman California Democratic Senator Joe Dunn cast a deciding vote, siding with two Republicans. The bill mirrored an Oregon law allowing doctors to prescribe a lethal prescription to terminally ill patients. California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger suggested earlier this year he would not sign such a bill because the issue of physician-assisted suicides is of such importance it should be left to voters.
An almost 2 percentage point interest rate increase for federal student loans will kick in this weekend, and advisors say that not refinancing could cost thousands of additional dollars in interest in the decades after a student enters the workforce. The federal government adjusts interest rates on its student loans each July 1st based on a formula tied to the yield on short-term treasury bills. The variable rate on a common Stafford loan dipped to as low as 2.77% for students in the 2004-2005 school year, and 3.37% for graduates already making repayments. Those rates rose last year to 4.7% for students and 5.3% for graduates. On Saturday, the rates will shoot up to 6.54% for students and 7.14% for graduates. Although the specific rates are different, they're rising by a similar margin for parents who take out loans to pay for their children's education. Students and parents can lock in rates near the current levels by refinancing before Saturday.
And sponsors of a 2002 initiative filed a complaint with the State Elections Division Friday, alleging that 8 of this year's initiative campaigns are violating the ban on paying signature gatherers by signature instead of by the hour. The complaint was filed by Tim Nesbitt and Ellen Lowe, the co-sponsors of Ballot Measure 26, which voters enacted in 2002. Campaign reformers say that paying signature gatherers by the signature encourages fraud and false promises about what an initiative measure entails in order to get people to sign petitions. Measure 26 required paying signatures gatherers by the hour. Compliance, working with the labor-backed group Our Oregon, submitted evidence allegedly showing that some petition companies are skirting the law. Details of the complaint won't be divulged because there might be criminal allegations involved, said John Lindback, the director of the Elections Division. Chief petitioners of Initiative Campaign must sign statements indicating that they won't pay signature gatherers by the signature. This from the Salem Statesman Journal.
The Bush administration will issue new regulations today that clarify what states can count to fulfill work requirements for welfare. Under the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families program, states are supposed to have at least half of their welfare recipients in approved work activities or face cuts in funding of up to 5%. But states have been on their own in defining what are work activities. Congress recently instructed the Department of Health and Human Services to draft regulations that would define the 12 work categories cited in federal law. For instance, on-the-job training will be defined, as will community service and unsubsidized employment. The Government Accountability Office said last year that there were too many differences in how states defined work. The GAO said inconsistent definitions make for unreliable comparisons when determining which states do a good job of helping residents find work. But some social service analysts worry that the new approach could stifle innovative state programs. They say such approaches have helped reduce welfare rolls by 57% over the past decade.
And more than 1,000 firefighters fought lightning-sparked blazes that had burned more than 80,000 acres across northern Nevada. The fires were among 32 large ones burning in 8 western states, according to the National Fire Information Center in Boise, Idaho. Nevada Governor Kenny Guinn declared a state of emergency Tuesday afternoon. The declaration will help local governments get federal assistance to restore firefighting resources. As many as 300 homes and businesses east of Carson City were threatened by a pair of brush fires that expanded overnight to 6,000 acres. The flames curved around the state's capital city. Despite the continued threats, the Moonlight Bunny Ranch brothel remained open. In Arizona, authorities escorted hundreds of tourists around the fire that had marooned them since the weekend at the lodge, cabins, and campgrounds on the north rim of the Grand Canyon. Wildfire had jumped the only highway leading to the area, but the flames were about 30 miles from the park, and officials said no one was in any danger.
A constitutional amendment to ban flag desecration died in the Senate, in a Senate cliffhanger yesterday, a single vote short of the support needed to send it to the states for ratification a week before Independence Day. The 66-34 tally in favor of the amendment was one less than the two-thirds required. The House surpassed that threshold last year, 286-130. The proposed amendment, sponsored by Republican Senator Orrin Hatch of Utah, reads, "The Congress shall have power to prohibit the physical desecration of the flag of the United States." Senate supporters said the flag amounts to a national monument in cloth that represents freedom and the sacrifice of American troops. Opponents say the amendment would violate the First Amendment right to free speech. And some Democrats complained that majority Republicans were exploiting people's patriotism for political advantage in the midterm elections. The last time the Senate considered the amendment, in 2000, it fell four votes short of what was needed. Both sides predicted rightly before Tuesday's vote that it would get more support.
According to a report released yesterday, it says that there's no foolproof way to secure America's seaports against terrorism, and that the government should focus more time and money on plans to revive the economy in the aftermath of an attack. The recommendation by the nonprofit Public Policy Institute of California was based partly on its findings that almost 5 years after the September 11th attacks, many of the nation's 361 ports are still highly vulnerable. Cargo containers pose the biggest threat, yet only a fraction of the 10 million shipped to the country every year get fully inspected. Limited staffing and funding have led to unclear priorities and uncoordinated strategies among port security authorities. And programs to credential port workers, buy new Coast Guard ships, planes, and helicopters, and protect international cargo have lagged. The report claims that to lessen any disruption to commerce following an attack, the government could devise better ways to sort safe cargo from high-risk cargo, as well as a system for prioritizing containers in the backlog of ships offshore. Authorities often cite ports as top terrorist targets. And aside from insulating the economy from an attack, the study's authors recommended that authorities pursue new defense such as several tracking, screening, and inspection points for shipping containers, improving emergency response at ports, and strengthening terrorism insurance markets. They also said the federal government should offer better policy guidance and set aside money and personnel based on actual risks, and consider boosting the amount of money spent on port security.
Residents of four public housing complexes in New Orleans are suing to open their apartments that have been closed since Hurricane Katrina. The plaintiffs claim the federal government's plan to demolish their homes is discriminatory, and they say it violates international laws protecting people displaced by natural disasters. Critics have been staging marches and have set up a tent city to protest the Department of Housing and Urban Development's decision to tear down the buildings after Katrina. They say the agency's plan would drive black families out of the city. HUD says it wants to revamp the city's public housing stock by destroying old and unsafe complexes and replacing them with mixed-income neighborhoods. Before Katrina, 5,100 families lived in public housing units in New Orleans, and only 1,100 have returned since the storm.
And yesterday was designated a National Day of Action to stand up with First Lieutenant Aaron Watada, the first commissioned U.S. military officer to publicly refuse orders to support the Iraq War. Several hundred supporters gathered for a rally of support on the I-5 overpass near the entrance to Fort Lewis yesterday afternoon. They held banners and signs, and his mother and father and stepmother all spoke proudly in support of their son. Watada is confined to quarters at Fort Lewis, awaiting action by Army officials. He is not a conscientious objector, but he argues that the Iraq War is illegal, and as a commissioned officer, it is his duty to decide himself whether he is ordered to do is illegal. Supporters hope that Lieutenant Watada will be discharged from the Army, but fear he will be court-martialed. For further information, visit their website, www.thankyoult.org.
The United Nations says some 150,000 Iraqis have been displaced in a surge of sectarian violence sparked by the bombing of a Shiite shrine 4 months ago. The UN office in Baghdad said it now estimates that 1.3 million people are displaced in Iraq, about 5% of the population of 25 million. The statement was expressing concern about the wave of violence which began when attackers bombed the 1,200-year-old Askariya Shrine in Samarra on February 22nd. It triggered reprisal attacks against Sunni mosques and clerics. On Monday, bombs killed at least 40 people at markets in two cities. Unrest and violence following the toppling of Saddam Hussein's regime have also fueled the refugee crisis, with Shiites and Sunnis fleeing their mixed neighborhoods after receiving threats from rival groups seeking to stoke sectarian tension in the country. The UN findings come 2 days after Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki announced a reconciliation plan on Sunday, offering limited amnesty to opposition fighters. The UN statement said displacement has occurred across Iraq, not just Samarra. An estimated 3,200 families have fled Ramadi in the last 2 weeks because of U.S.-led military operations.
And on Monday, the U.S. occupying forces and Iraqi soldiers pushed into the heart of the Iraqi city of Ramadi, the capital of Anbar province, in part of a bigger plan to regain control of the city, which they claim has become a hotbed of insurgent attacks. This from Al Jazeera. Army Colonel Sean McFarlane, who commands a division that now controls Ramadi and the nearby part of the Anbar province, was quoted as saying that the U.S. occupying army will stay there until sometime next year, along with two brigades of Iraqi soldier. Fearing a fierce and deadly offensive similar to that carried out in November of 2004 by the U.S. occupation forces in Fallujah, residents started pouring out of Ramadi, a city of almost a half million people, to escape in an imminent humanitarian crisis. Iraqi officials and the city residents who decided not to leave before their children finish their school exams reported massive U.S. airstrikes on several residential areas. Tribal leaders and fleeing families painted a bleak image of the city, with civilians trapped in the crossfire. The city is running out of food and essential medical supplies, and also the remaining residents are complaining that prices for gas have gone skyrocketing as a result of noticeable shortages. As Dar Jamail reported for Interpress Service, the residents are suffering from a lack of water, electricity, cooking gas, medical supplies for the hospitals, and the streets are eerily empty, and it appears that many people have now left the city. U.S. soldiers went from door to door, destroying personal property and shooting at anything that moved in the streets, terrorizing the remaining families in the city.
The prosecutor in the first federal U.S. trial over the UN Oil for Food program said yesterday he would show evidence of cash, stuffed envelopes, intrigue, and back-channel communications with Baghdad. Prosecutor Michael Farbiaz laid out his case during opening arguments at the trial of South Korean lobbyist Tong Sun Park. Park is accused of acting as an unregistered foreign agent of former Iraqi President Saddam Hussein in the scandal-ridden oil for food program. Farbiaz said evidence would show Park began receiving substantial amounts of money from Iraq in 1996, and by the end of the year, the oil for food program was in place. But defense attorney Michael Kim said Park was, quote, just a middleman or facilitator, like almost everybody else involved in the giant international game of oil and money, unquote. Kim urged jurors not to be blinded by the prosecution's presentation of intrigue and reminded them that Park was not charged with spying or selling access to the United Nations. Park faces charges in U.S. District Court of conspiracy to commit wire fraud, acting as an unregistered agent of a foreign government, and money laundering. He's pleaded not guilty and faces a maximum of 5 years in prison and a $250,000 fine if convicted.
And a behind-the-scenes battle is raging between the U.S. Department of State and the Defense Department about whether a key section of the Geneva Convention should be included in new rules governing army interrogation techniques. This from the Interpress Service. The Pentagon is looking to omit a central principle of the Geneva Conventions that explicitly bans humiliating and degrading treatment from new detainee policies. Critics say such a step that would mark a further shift away from strict adherence to international human rights standards. The State Department is opposing the decision to exclude the Geneva Convention protections and has been pushing for the Pentagon and White House to reconsider. With the growing criticism over U.S. treatment of detainees, Pentagon officials decided to make public all of the military's interrogation techniques. Military leaders had previously argued that making all of the interrogation tactics public would allow enemy combatants to train and prepare for specific techniques. The Pentagon's decision came as two previously secret Army investigative reports on prisoner abuse were released to the American Civil Liberties Union under a Freedom of Information request. The Formica report reviewed only three allegations of abuse by special operation forces, but found that Iraqi detainees were held for up to 7 days at a time with their eyes taped shut in tiny box-like cells so small that they had to sit with their knees to their chests while loud music blared, and detainees were fed only bread and water for up to a week. The report found that conditions did not comport with the spirit of the principles of the set forth in the Geneva Conventions, but said that the prisoners were not physically abused or humiliated, and that none of the detainees seemed to be the worse for wear because of the treatment. U.S. congressional panel has backed a controversial plan to share civilian nuclear technology with India. The deal offers U.S. nuclear technology to India in exchange for inspectors' access to Indian civilian reactors. The House of Representatives International Relations Committee voted 37-5 for the deal, which must still be put to another panel and to Congress. The agreement was hailed as historic by supporters, although critics say it will damage non-proliferation efforts. President Bush finalized the agreement during a landmark trip to India in March. Under the deal, energy-hungry India will get access to U.S. civil nuclear technology and fuel in return for opening its civilian nuclear facilities to inspection. The agreement reverses U.S. policy, which has restricted nuclear cooperation since India, which has not signed a nuclear non-proliferation treaty, tested a nuclear warhead in 1974. The critics of the deal say it could boost India's arsenal and sends a wrong message to countries like Iran, whose nuclear ambitions Washington opposes. This is from the BBC.
Palestinians began bracing for a major assault by Israel after Israeli troops and tanks bombed bridges at a power station to pressure militants to release a captured soldier. It was Israel's latest offensive, and Palestinians holed up at home were bracing for a major strike. Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert said Israel wouldn't balk at extreme action to bring home the soldier, but had no intention of reoccupying Gaza. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas deplored the incursion as a crime against humanity, and a leading Hamas politician issued a call to arms against the Israeli troops. Overnight, Israeli tanks and soldiers began taking up positions east of the Gaza town of Rafah under cover of tank shells. Israeli warplanes fired at least 9 missiles at Gaza's only power station, cutting electricity to 65% of the Gaza Strip. The station's 3 functioning turbines and a gas reservoir were engulfed in flames, raising the specter of a humanitarian crisis in Gaza, where water pumps are powered by electricity. The Israeli military said in a statement that 3 bridges were also attacked, but Palestinian security officials said knocking down the bridges cut Gaza in 2. Witnesses reported heavy artillery shelling near the long-closed Gaza airport into a village east of Rafah, and warplanes also flew low over Gaza City, rocking the city with sonic booms and shattering windows. Troops in Israel backed up the assault, firing artillery into Gaza. Olmert repeated that Israel will not negotiate Shalit's release with militant groups. Corporal Shalit was captured on Sunday during a Palestinian attack on a military post in southern Israel.
2 Nigerian journalists have denied charges of sedition linked to a story about new presidential aircraft. The Daily Independent wrote Team Durage was charged after one of his articles questioned the cost and age of President Olusegun Obasanjo's plane. The other journalist, Genja Arulaba, was arrested after discussing the article on his talk show on private television station. The two men face up to 2 years in prison if convicted. They are accused of seeking to bring into hatred or contempt or excite dissatisfaction against the person of the president. Their bail application was denied. The New York-based Committee to Project Journalists has condemned the arrest of Arubala. The government's opponents have accused it of cracking down on criticism ahead of next year's election. This from the BBC.
Somalia's Islamist militia have taken control of a key road junction south of their Mogadishu stronghold despite last week's ceasefire. Five people died in the battle for the road that links the capital to the interim government's base in Baidoa. Meanwhile, in Islamist-controlled Jawar, three men face death by stoning if convicted of rape by an Islamic court. The charges come a day after the new Islamist leader said he would only back a government based on Islamic law. Sheikh Hassan Dahir Awe Somali Supreme Islamic Court's counsel is due to hold talks with the weak interim government next month. Interim President Abdullah Yusuf strongly opposes political Islam.
And Peru's Congress overwhelmingly voted to ratify a free trade pact with the United States early today, following a six-hour debate that was interrupted by a small group of recently elected nationalist lawmakers who burst in onto the legislative floor in show of opposition. The 120-member legislature approved the bilateral deal reached between Peru and Washington late last year and signed in April by President Alejandro Toledo's government. The ratification received the full backing of President-elect Alan Garcia's 28-member Aprista bloc party. Toledo's administration lobbied fiercely for ratification before Garcia is sworn in on July 28th, along with the new Congress, which will have a strong anti-free trade opposition led by presidential runner-up Ollanta Humala, who lost in the June 4th runoff to Garcia. About 2 hours into the debate, several legislator-elect from Humala's Nationalistic Alliance got past security guards to enter the Congress floor, pumping their fists in the air, waving placards and chanting anti-free trade slogans, causing the legislature's president to call for a half-hour suspension of the session while the protesters were forced to leave the building. Humala maintains a free trade deal, which still lacks a nod from the U.S. Congress, would flood Peru with subsidized U.S. agricultural goods, making it impossible for local producers to compete.
And in Mexico, as the election approaches, opinion polls give the candidate of the Party of Democratic Revolution a slight lead over Felipe Calderón of the governing center-right National Action Party. If López Obrador wins, Latin America's much-talked-about leftward march will have reached the United States' back door. If he loses, in the wake of electoral disappointments in Colombia and Peru, it will look like the retreat has begun. Fox's limp legacy allows López Obrador to claim he is the real change that the electorate has wanted all along, with many of his diehard supporters convinced that only fraud can snatch victory from their hero. The possibility of tension on the streets is real if Obrador's main rival wins by a narrow margin. Love him, hate him, or just watch him, López Obrador is the candidate to beat and may well remain at the center of the post-electoral show even if he loses. This according to The Guardian.
This has been the KBOO Morning News for Wednesday, June 28, 2006. Portland area weather calls for partly cloudy with highs in the low 80s, and tonight also cloudy with temperatures in the mid-50s. Today's news editor was Brian Smith. Our assistant editor was Chris Andre. Our engineer is Boone Rivas with help from Dusty. And Kathleen Stevenson is the KBOO AM News and Public Affairs Director. I'm Brian Smith.
And I'm Chris Andre.
We clear the air at 90.7 FM in Portland, 91.9 in the Columbia River Gorge on Translator K246AA, and 100.7 in the Willamette Valley on Translator K220HR. If you'd like to volunteer in the AM newsroom, call Kathleen Stevenson at 503-231-8032, extension 202, or email at amnews@kboo.org.